Folks, this is Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. Here's the way this podcast works from a production standpoint. Simon Foster and I will have a little bit of a chin wag. We'll discuss the issues of the day, discuss what's happening with our lives, our families, our dogs. You know, we go through it all. And then I come up with something to have as a bit of a funny opening to the podcast, but not this week. Not doing that. Got no interest in doing it because here's why. In our little pre-production quote unquote meeting, Simon Foster's like, hey, I want to sing more songs in the opening. I thought that was a terrible idea until he pitched what he really wants to do this week, which is sing Hooray for Hollywood as our intro to the Screen Watching podcast. Simon Foster, please, the floor is yours.
Hooray for Hollywood, that crazy, lazy, hazy Hollywood. I don't know all the words to this song, but I will soldier on because that's what I do. Anyway, let's get on with the podcast.
Both worse and better than I expected. Folks, this is Screen Watching.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television, teacher, mother.
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Ladies, gentlemen, and other identified dignitaries, this is Screen Watching. We're here to talk about what we've watched on the screens, the big screens, the small screens, the medium average screens. We discuss it all here on the podcast. That's movies, TVs, and like other stuff on screens. I don't know. We really do TV and movies.
Game Boy.
Yeah. Game Boy. Yeah. But black and white Game Boy, because we hear the OG here. Folks.
Love it.
I'm going to dive into this. My name is Dan Barrett. I'm joined by Simon Foster. Simon Foster. Are you well? Please tell me that you're well, because I couldn't cope if you weren't.
This is the most exciting week of the screen watching year for me, Dan Barrett. You know my thoughts on the Oscars. It's my Christmas. I am gearing up for this weekend or this Monday, if you're here in Australia, broadcast of the Oscars to be hosted by Jimmy Kimmel. On top of that, Dan Barrett, you know what a couch athlete I am. The NRL returns after the massive event in Las Vegas last weekend. Test cricket is coming in from New Zealand. And the Major League Baseball is in preseason. My television is in meltdown. I keep getting those reminders. Are you still watching? Do you want to change the channel? Do you want to turn it off? And I go, nope, I'm still watching. It's been hours now. So I'm excited. Oscars, sport, I couldn't be happier. Don't spoil my mood.
Look, it's been a pretty big week for me as well in terms of TV watching because I am in my final 10 episodes of my LA Law rewatch. So, you know, very similar.
Is that still going on? Still happening. Good Lord. And you've got some exciting news about a whole new, entry into the franchise in this week's show. So this has worked out perfectly.
Well, it's a different franchise. It's an entirely different show, Simon. Okay, look, Simon's already let the cat out of the bag. We're going to talk about a franchise. It's not LA Law, though. Simon just hears the word law and just goes deep into things, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's addled, and I'm not talking about, like, Joe Biden addled. I'm talking about, like, it's an actual problem. Anyway, here's where we're at. Okay, so, yes, I am watching LA Law. I've got 10 episodes left. Simon doesn't understand because he's a movie critic and he's like, oh, well, an experience of watching something just goes for 2 hours. No, Simon, it goes for 146 hours if you do it properly. Now, that's neither here.
Okay. That's what Oppenheimer felt like.
On the podcast this week, we are talking about the Academy Awards. So in the middle of the podcast, we are going to look at some podcasts will be putting out their lists of this is who's going to win. Here's how you can help with your betting pool. Here's, deep dives on the Academy Awards at large. We're not really doing that. What we're going to do here is, and I'm probably just interrupting the intros to the actual segment later on, but I'm explaining what we're going to do. The award shows, Simon loves them. I'm a bit more critical about them. The Academy Awards is more legitimate than most, okay? But even so, and look, this is something I've natted on about a whole bunch on this podcast in the last couple of years. Increasingly, the idea of a podcast that just looks at movies and, sorry, an award show that just looks at movies, an award show that just looks at TV, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me in the current landscape.
Here he goes. Oh, boy.
Well, I just kind of figure that it needs to be more like the Golden Globes, where you're celebrating both in some way and do that in a really smart way. Which
reflects- You heard it here first, everyone. Dan wants award shows to be more like the Golden Globes. Well done, Dan Barrett.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but, you know, legitimate, counted properly and whatnot.
You want Joe Coy back as the host.
I mean, I didn't watch the last Golden Globe, so I don't actually really know if that's the case. But weirdly, this is the second Joe Coy reference I've heard people make at me today, which is quite unexpected. Anyway.
Come back.
So look, we're going to take a look at, when we're thinking about the awards, the way that it works is a lot of campaigning, there's a lot of negotiating, there's a lot of shows and movies in this instance, that are put up purely because of who's representing them, and there's a lot of Hollywood politicking that takes place to settle on that final list. But instead of just doing a list of, hey, this is who should be nominated, we're going to look at the pool that have actually been created and say, of this group of five movies, which one is the one that should be the winner? Not who probably will win.
I like that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Wow. Oh, Simon, that is a good idea. You came up with that.
I wish you'd read my emails and my poetry, but moving on. We're going to do that later on the show. Also, we've got the reviews. That's what we do here on the show. I'm going to look at the latest Law & Order TV program. Is it an SVU? No. Is it a Criminal Intent? Kind of. It's Law & Order, Criminal Intent, Toronto. This is a Canadian. Toronto, eh? Yeah. We'll do all the poutine jokes. Yeah. Then, once we've done that, Simon's going to take a look at some movie. I don't remember what was on your list. Simon, what are you talking about this week?
We're talking about one of the very sort of hot indie films of the year. It's called How to Have Sex. And I will also be reviewing a Netflix movie with Adam Sandler called Spaceman. No, Spaceman. Sorry, I read that wrongly. So, yes, that's getting quite a bit of buzz around town.
Okay, well, after Simon talks about How to Have Sex, I'll probably need at least 15, 20 minutes of quiet time to myself. But I'll also come back later with a discussion about The Gentlemen, which is streaming now on Netflix. It's Guy Ritchie's, I think, first TV series. It's a lot of shows. And then we've got birthday quizzes. We've got This Week in History. There's a whole lot of things. Folks, This is Screen Watching, and we're going to go straight now into the reviews.
It stinks. Welcome back, everyone. If there's anybody on this podcast qualified to review a movie called How to Have Sex, it's me. I'm 55 and I've been doing it quite well now for a couple of years.
I'm going in!
What's your name?
Tara.
So, How to Have Sex is the new indie film that is making quite a buzz around the world. It just won the Best New Director at the BAFTAs for filmmaker Molly Manning Walker. On the surface, it feels a little bit like a lot of films we've seen so far, the trials and tribulations of entering into sort of coming out of that innocence of your early teens and heading into that kind of dark, murky, confusing place that is your mid-teens. It tells the story of three girls led by the wonderful Mia McKenna. I better get her name right because she's terrific in this. Mia McKenna-Bruce, she plays Tara Shee along with Lara Peake as Sky and Anna Antanianides. Move into a beach hut to celebrate their summer and go crazy and go wild and go drinking and clubbing and meeting boys and doing all the crazy things you can do, which you should do when you're in your mid to late teens. These girls seem very young to be doing this. Only two of them have had sexual experience. Young Mia McKenna-Bruce is still a virgin, and the other girls joke with her quite openly about that. And she finds herself kind of attracted to the boys in the apartment block next door, one of which is a kind of nice guy who seems sort of gentlemanly in a working class kind of way. But then there's the other guy, Paddy, who's quite the predator and exactly the kind of evil influence that you find on these sort of trips when there's a lot of booze and a lot of loose morales and everything goes to hell for this young woman who was just there to have a good time. when the film takes a dark turn, it's a very dark turn. She is manipulated into a sexual act that is horrific in the way Patty sort of performs and like manipulates her mind and forces himself upon her. And then it's how she interacts with the other two girls and how she's able to confide in one but have to be super cautious of the other one. So what starts off as a really sort of upbeat, fun adventure suddenly becomes this tearing down of all that was innocence about Tara's life, the friendship she thought she had with these two girls, the interaction with boys she thought was initially innocent but then turns bad, and this week away for her is a life-changing experience. It ends on a kind of hopeful note, but also you can see that this girl has been changed terribly for the rest of her life. So although it sort of looks and feels like a party atmosphere kind of movie, there's a lot to take away from this. I did think of you when I watched this, Dan, because I know you've got all these moments ahead of you as a young father, and Murphy's going to grow into these sort of problems and this kind of life maybe, and you'll have to deal with this. And I dealt with it as a father as well. So it's a challenging film to watch for people of all ages, but it's a brilliant piece of low-budget filmmaking and is finally hitting cinemas here in Australia. We're kind of one of the last territories to get it. So do try and get along to see it.
I've actually got a game plan around that, Simon.
Oh, you do? You've thought this out forwardly? Forwardly?
Yeah. So, look, I think it's probably going to be most successful if I just do this. No.
Oh, that's solid parenting right there. Yeah. No, that's good.
Yep.
And I'm sure she'll say, okay, Dad.
Yeah. He knows best. Yeah. That's how to go. Yeah. Okay. All right. Pretty sure. Now, anyway, let's move on. Simon, when I'm also thinking about sex, you're top of mind of me as well. But I'm not going to talk about that. Instead, I'm going to talk about the latest Law & Order franchise extension. It's called Law & Order Criminal Intent Toronto.
In Toronto's war on crime,
I'm Detective Graff. This is Detective Bateman.
The worst offenders are pursued by the detectives of the Specialized Criminal Investigations Unit. These are their stories.
I'm going to be real, Simon. I don't know where the colons and the hyphens fit into this at all, but here's what I can tell you. Law & Order is a franchise that's been running for many, many, many years. Jack McCoy was a big part of many of it. We discussed that at length in last week's show. We will not revisit.
We sure did.
What we can revisit, though, is at one point there was a franchise spinoff called Law & Order Criminal Intent. Now, I've never seen Law & Order Criminal Intent, despite the fact that it stars Vincent D'Onofrio, which, you know, that's kind of appealing to me. Yeah. And so...
And Catherine Irby, she was the lead, wasn't she? Catherine Irby, who was a terrific actress.
Yeah, I believe so. I was going to say that, but I wasn't 100% sure and it wasn't up on my screen, so I was just going to fake my way through that part of it. But I believe that's right. If that's who I had in my mind, that's who you said, then I'm pretty sure it's her.
Definitely.
Yeah, so look, you had those two leading the show, and you may have seen it, Simon, so maybe you can support me on this one. But what I believe that the difference between Law & Order the show was and Law & Order the Criminal Intent show was is that Law & Order splits itself into talking about the relationship between the police and the judiciary and the way that intersects and supports each other and, you know, separates at times. And so you see things from both perspectives there. Criminal Intent stuck with the police through the investigation for the full hour-long episode. Okay, but we saw more of an insight into the lives of the people, the murderers, the victims, etc. So we get more of a personal stake from them. Is that correct, Simon?
That's true to a certain extent. It's really yes. No, I'll tick that and say yes. Although it was also about the personal lives and the interactions of the officers and the investigating officers as well, which I think came to infuse more of the Law & Order series later on down the track as well, because those first few years were very much procedural, but that changed.
Yeah, so that's my understanding as well. So what we have here is the Canadian version of Criminal Intent. So we don't see the Canadian lawyers and judges and whatnot. All we see is the Canadian police officers, the detectives, doing their investigation. And what you find is that because we're not really dealing with a structure, okay, like a legal system, because we're not really dealing with that and we're just dealing with an investigation, the actual differences between an American police investigation and a Canadian police investigation are very, very similar. So what you've got here is a Canadian series that looks and feels like it could just be the American law and order, just maybe in a smaller city. What's maybe a little bit more, I guess, notable or just maybe sort of slightly different is just they've got Canadian accents and everyone's a bit more polite and it's just a bit more genial as they sort of travel around. Beyond that, you're pretty much just seeing a Law and Order Criminal Intent, and it's weird. But what I will say, if I want to talk about the show from a quality perspective, is that I'd noted when we were talking about Law and Order last week that Law and Order has made a very big shift in what it's interested in, where it's not just talking about the murder case of the week, but instead there's a very strong element of justice and justice through a 2024 lens being discussed with every episode. In this, you don't really have any of that. It's a pretty straight down the line, very traditional murder mystery. And as a result, it kind of just feels a little bit dated and a little bit out of time and space. Part of that is because it's a Toronto Law and Order. So it immediately just feels a little bit sort of strange and doesn't quite feel entirely right. And the accents are slightly off. But, you know, I mean, it's kind of fine for generic drama, but it never elevates at any point. We really are seeing a very average procedural here. There's nothing that elevates it. Even the performances of the two actors, which I'm looking up right now because I forgot to note that before Aiden. I sort of dive into it. Aiden Young is the lead guy,
an Australian-Canadian actor. He was based in Australia and did a lot of work here in Australia, but he's an Australian-Canadian actor. And I remember him most from Black Robe, maybe, that Bruce Beresford film from many, many years ago. Oh, yeah. But he's done some good work along the way. I don't recognize any of the others.
Well, Kathleen Munro is the co-star in it. And look, she's perfectly capable. And Aidan Young, I thought, was perfectly fine in the lead as well. They were clearly trying to make him sort of a little bit quirky in some respects. But by and large, nothing really jumps out of this one. So look, if you're a Law and Order diehard and you're looking for just a bit more Law and Order in your week, I'd throw this into the mix. But it's not essential TV at all. And certainly from me, who feels a little bit dubious watching as much Law and Order as I have recently, it's probably not something that I'm throwing into my regular viewing mixture on a weekly basis.
Can I just ask, there's been a couple of, and forgive me if I'm wrong, I know I do get my Law and Orders and my LA Law and all those mixed up along the way, but we went to London for Law and Order. Didn't we have a Law and Order London at one point?
Okay, so look, that's probably an interesting thing we can talk about. So when I've done let me just
finish. The only point I want to make is, what is the value other than being able to transport a franchise to a new location? The what?
I'm about to answer that. I've got that for you. So
okay, all right, let's hear it.
What's been different with the previous incarnations of Law and Order where they've taken her overseas? So there is a London version, and I think there's a couple of other foreign language versions as well around the place. I'm not a Law and Order-ologist, so I'm not 100% sure on that, but I believe that there's a couple of others. Is that when I've done those adaptations, they've actually been adapting scripts from the Law and Order original series for those local markets and changing it slightly to meet the legal system requirement. Yeah. So it's never really quite felt entirely authentic to each of these locations. And keep in mind that we don't really know, like you and I, we should know Law and Order London. Like we should be across that. But, you know, it was never really a particularly successful program. And it did run for a few seasons. Like it was never a big TV success by any means. And I would attribute the reason why it never really quite took off is purely because it wasn't really authentic to the British experience. Okay. Like, not every show is necessarily going to be particularly amazing, but it doesn't really help things when it doesn't feel authentic to that it's set in. And I think that's the case. Toronto, though, these are original scripts and it's being written very much with a Canadian mindset and a Canadian sort of way into it. In a lot of ways, it's very similar to what NCIS Sydney have done recently, which is that they really have set up a local program that's been left to its own devices. Because, look, here's something interesting about Sydney, which I heard through some scuttlebutt, which is that when they were producing that show, it was with almost no like, I was going to say interference, but that's probably not the right word entirely. But it was with no real engagement with the franchise holders after the green light had been given on the series. Like, there was no meetings to make sure that it was in line with, you know, a particular flavor or anything. They just said, you know, go have at it, which I find really interesting. I get the feeling that's exactly what's happened with this Law and Order Criminal Intent Toronto program. I think they've just been given carte blanche to go and do a local version of their show.
My other main question about Law and Order Toronto, are they on horseback?
Look, they are not Mounties. They are regular police officers. So, no, they're not on horseback.
Oh, that's a missed opportunity. Oh, no. Okay. All right, fine. So, Law, where do we watch this? Because I didn't see this pop up on any of my, streaming guides or anything. Where do we watch this?
Yeah, look, I was curious about this program because I was interested to see what they were going to do with it from a Canadian perspective. So I went through some internet black magic to download it. So I had it ready to go. And then I flipped on Binge and then just suddenly saw it there. So Binge has become the home of all the Law and Orders, and you can watch those usually day and day.
Okay, good to know. Law and Order Criminal Intent Toronto is on Binge. How to Have Sex is in limited release. I think, Dan Barrett, we're at the Oscar hot take segment, the intermission.
I feel really uncomfortable How to Have Sex and hearing the phrase limited release. But anyway, yeah, let's go on to the intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, live from the Kodak Theatre here in downtown Los Angeles. This is the Screen Watching's Oscars Hot Take Intermission. I'm here on the red carpet with Dan Barrett, prognosticator to the stars, a man who has picked every Best Picture winner since 1927's Wings. Dan Barrett, welcome to the midsection, the intermission of Screen Watching. Now, look. You going to say something?
Sorry, you were interrupting me and you're just going for something now. What are we saying, Simon?
Okay. So the Academy Awards are never entirely about the quality of the films or the work of those nominated. A lot of it's based on relationships, campaigns, the proximity to nominees. That's a word you don't hear very often. And because Hollywood is like a big, fancier, more attractive high school, the popularity. This is a popularity contest, obviously, generally, mostly. That's debatable. But this week, we're making the awards legitimate. In your words, Dan Barrett, we're going to run through the nominees and determine who should win, not who might win or who deserves to win, or maybe who deserves to win, who should win. Dan's got some views on my opinion on The Holdovers. We've got maybe similar views on Killers of the Flower Moon. There's going to be some surprises in this discussion. Dan Barrett, how do you want to do this? Where are we going to kick things off?
So, look, I wrote part of that spiel that you just gave then. And the reason I said proximity to talent was because, and this is the Oscar story that really just amused the heck out of me in the last week or two. Apparently, there was an Oscars luncheon, which pissed off a whole lot of people because the Anatomy of a Fall crew ended up bringing the dog from the movie to the luncheon. They flew out the dog from France to hang out at the luncheon. Okay. And essentially, there were a lot of concerns that they were kind of buying favoritism with people because they had like a cute experience with the dog and therefore they'd be more likely to vote for the movie, which I think is hilarious. But like, that's the sort of thing that takes place as part of the campaigning. Essentially, you have your actors and writers and directors and everyone else who are going out to all these events. So often you do hear stories about people who have voted for someone purely because they had the chance to meet them or they were, you know, just part of broader chat. So that's what I mean when I say proximity. And that's partly why when you think about, oh, this person didn't deserve to win. Well, it just meant they put on a really good campaign to win their prize. It wasn't necessarily based on the work that they did. So that's kind of you just take this with a little bit of a tongue in cheek as you look at it, a bit of a grain of salt.
On the scale of manipulative gestures that the Hollywood has used to win Oscar awards, bringing a dog to a lunch is kind of low. That's well down the scale, let's say. So, all right, let's wrap.
No, but Simon, that luncheon would have just gone by completely unremarked upon. But there was so much coverage around that luncheon purely because there were lots of reporters who wanted to talk about the dog being there. So suddenly the Anatomy of a Fall movie and the dog got a lot more coverage than it would have otherwise. So there is actually something to the idea that that actually is a major pivot point within a campaign. But yeah, I mean, it's also, you know, just dumb and fun. Yeah.
All right, let's have a look at the major categories. Let's jump in at the writing end of things, the original and the adapted screenplays. Now, I'm going to read through the original screenplays. Is this how you want to do this? You want me to sort of present them and we're going to have a stab at what will win, what should win?
Yeah, if you can don your evening dress, that would be fantastic for this.
All right, yep, a nice off-the-shoulder number. Plunging Neckline. Original screenplay, Anatomy of a Fall, The Holdovers, Maestro, May, December, and Past Lives. All fine films amongst them. The feeling is probably from that lot, Anatomy of a Fall will win. Dan Barrett, who should win? I know where this is going.
Anatomy of a Fall. Like, I just think that was spectacular in terms of screenplay, direction, acting. You're going to hear me mention that film a lot through this conversation. That said, it actually hurts me a little bit to say so definitively Anatomy of a Fall, because I do think the screenplay for The Holdovers is exceptionally strong. So, you know, it'd be of those two, but certainly I think Anatomy of a Fall is the stronger.
I think this is a really telling category. If Anatomy of a Fall picks up this award, I think they will give some indication that it might be a bit of an Anatomy of a Fall night. On the other hand, if it picks up this award, it may be all that Justin Triet, the director and the writer of Anatomy of a Fall, gets, and they give the best director category to another person who we'll get to later. I also think Anatomy of a Fall should get that. And as much as I loved Past Lives, which would probably be my second choice, I got no problem with Anatomy of a Fall continuing its award season run and picking up another trophy there. Adapted screenplay, American Fiction, Barbie, Oppenheimer, Poor Things, The Zone of Interest. Whew, this is a tough one. This is a tough one because there's a lot of love for American Fiction. Cord Jefferson just won, what did he just win? The Independent Spirit Award, I think, for this, his American Fiction screenplay. Wow, where do you go with this? Is it going to be a double for Christopher Nolan, this and the directing award? I don't know. This is a tough category. Who should win? Zone of Interest in my books. What will win? I don't know.
Yeah, look, I think Zone of Interest was probably the stronger of them all, but also Oppenheimer, I'm very open to the conversation about that being the best in that. Not only is it a very strong screenplay generally, but also the amount of research that Nolan put into that thing, you know, I think is just incredibly impressive. He really went above and beyond in terms of constructing that screenplay. I'm going to say Oppenheimer. There's a lot of worthy candidates on this one.
Put aside your anti Barbie point of view. Is there enough groundswell of support for them to say, all right, Greta and Noah and Margot, sorry, we really kind of got that wrong a little bit. Here's the adapted screenplay award. Is that a legitimate maybe?
So, look, I think there's a lot of conversations over have what they put together here. Is this legitimately a adapted screenplay or is it original? The strong argument is that it's not original because they are borrowing like established IP. So it's probably, I think, fairly clearly to me an adapted screenplay. I would actually say that because I think there's just so much enthusiasm and respect for what Nolan did around Oppenheimer, I think it's going to be really hard to have Barbie sort of be put up as being better than that Oppenheimer screenplay. But then as well, the other issue is Zone of Interest, I think, was a remarkable screenplay. I had a couple of issues with it here and there, but it's a really powerful work. I'd really have trouble putting Barbie ahead of the Holocaust drama.
You know, it's funny. I think of all the things that Oppenheimer can be praised for, the screenplay isn't immediately the thing that jumps out at me. I think Oppenheimer will sweep the technical side of things. I think it'll pick up all the sound design and effects and all that sort of stuff. The bottom, the below the line talent will win a lot for Oppenheimer. I think it's going to tighten up, and I think that's going to be reflected in the top few categories. I don't know if it's going to sweep through these Academy Awards like some think it do. Let's go to actress in a supporting role, Emily Blunt.
In terms of Oppenheimer, I think it really is a remarkable triumph in terms of writing, in terms of you have to think about the complexity of what they were doing there, in that not only were they talking about the scientific sort of achievement being made, they were talking about the military and scientific bureaucracy that went into being able to even develop the bomb, let alone being able to drop it. They developed the personal world of Oppenheimer, there was the political fallout from it, and all of this was intersecting timelines. This was all told with such great clarity that I don't think there were many viewers at home who particularly, in cinemas, but at home as well, who were confused by the events transpiring in this one. It did a lot of heavy lifting in a really nuanced, intricate way. I'm talking myself into it. I think that Oppenheimer is far and beyond the best written adapted screenplay.
Actress in a supporting role, we have Emily Blunt for Oppenheimer, Danielle Brooks for The Color Purple, America Ferrera for Barbie, Jodie Foster for Naiad, and Divine Joy Randolph for The Holdovers. Divine Joy has won all before her, and she'll probably take out this category in what I think is one of the more sure bets for the evening. This might also be the category where Barbie gets a little bit of a mention, although having said that, Barbie will probably get things like costume design and maybe it won't get set decoration over Poor Things. But anyway, the big speech that America Ferrera gives in Barbie that everyone has sort of pointed to as being the reason she got the nomination is worthy, and I wouldn't be surprised if it floats to the surface. The person in this category that should win is Jodie Foster for Naiad. She gives such a natural, heartfelt, real person performance in the role as Annette Bening's offsider in Naiad that I just found it was a wonder to watch. So natural, so real. Divine Joy Randolph will win here. There's a real run for her, and she's fine in Holdovers. I just thought Jodie's probably my should win over her will win. To you, Dan Barrett? Oh,
I'm in the bag for The Holdovers across the board. I'm in the bag for her except for when it comes across Anatomy of a Fall. It's Divine Joy Randolph. I think that watching it on screen was just exceptional. I still think about that performance, and that's pretty rare for acting generally for me.
Actor in a supporting role. I think there's another lock in here as well. Sterling K. Brown for American Fiction, Robert De Niro for Killers of the Flower Moon, Robert Downey Jr. for Oppenheimer, Ryan Gosling in Barbie, and Mark Ruffalo in Poor Things. Any other year, I think this could have been Ruffalo's role, sort of career reward role. He's been so liked for so long, and he was so different in Poor Things, yet still very effective. Early buzz that Gosling was going to get it for Barbie. I think his moment will come in performing the song on the night, and he'll get the award. He'll get the sort of the rousing reception that is probably what he deserves for the performance. But I think this is Oppenheimer. This is Robert Downey Jr.'s to lose, I think.
Yeah, I think really strong performance. And also I think that the Academy is just going to be interested in giving him an award. I think people like him. I think it was a performance that was worthy of the award. But I agree entirely with Ruffalo. And Ruffalo, I think, is really underrated. I think that quite regularly he puts in really strong work around the place. But often I think people just sort of confuse him for the romantic comedy and Incredible Hulk guy.
Yeah, and I couldn't motivate myself to do any real work the other afternoon, and I watched a movie of his from 2019 called Dark Waters, in which he played the the lawyer who took on DuPont in the case of the poisoning of the West Virginian towns for over 20 years. And he was terrific in that. Anne Hathaway's in there, Tim Robbins in there as well. I know that it was a sort of an award season contender early on when it came out, but it disappeared very quickly. Todd Haynes directed it, which I didn't know. Anyway, I digress. Actress in a leading role, Dan Barrett.
Can I just, Dark Water, I saw that in the cinema when it came out back in, a few years back.
Oh, really?
Film. Like, more people need to check that film out because it's very under the radar.
Terrific film. Yep. Actress in a leading role. I think this is one of the tougher categories to pick. Annette Bening in Naiad, Lily Gladstone, Killers of the Flower Moon, Sandra Hüller in Anatomy of a Fall, Carey Mulligan for Maestro, and Emma Stone from Poor Things. I think the way things are running, we can knock out Carey Mulligan and Annette Bening. And then you're really into just a hair's breadth between Emma, Sandra, and Lily Gladstone. I think that Anatomy of Fall is going to ride a bit of a wave here, and that she's also kind of hot potatoes because of Zone of Interest. So I think Sandra Hüller is going to take this for Anatomy of a Fall, which is going to ruffle a few feathers in the Lily Gladstone camp. I think Poor Things is coming in as everybody's sort of second or third choice in this year's Oscars, and I think Emma might suffer a little bit for that. I'm going to say Sandra Hüller, but not confidently.
So I think Sandra Hüller, I'm kind of just impressed. Well, not impressed, but maybe disappointed is probably where I'm really heading here, that she wasn't nominated for two different films in one category. Because when I look at the two performances, both Zone of Interest and Anatomy of a Fall, both those performances absolutely deserve to be nominated. Okay,
and at the same agree, time, but I would say supporting for Zone of Interest.
I look at that and... I don't know. I think the argument can be made either way. She's a pretty strong presence throughout that film. I saw that more as a two-hander than her supporting. But yeah, look, I mean, I think that... In Anatomy of a Fall, she completely blew me away. I was so just impressed by what I was seeing right through that film, and she was a very big part as to why that was a success. I'd say she's the one that deserves to win it. In terms of who will win it, I would imagine if I was sitting there with my ballot form in front of me and I was thinking about the culturally political conversation surrounding Lily Gladstone, and there's going to be lots of people who've bought into that who are going to award her. But if I was sitting there, I'd be thinking, well, I mean, she was pretty good. I don't think she was amazing. Okay. But, you know, in terms of wanting to represent someone, like, you know, maybe there's a bit of an argument to be made there. But also the film I didn't love, whereas Anatomy of a Fall I did love. And I could see myself, and also I really love Poor Things. I was really smitten with that. And I think that Emma Stone was actually pretty incredible with that one. It's a very bold, fearless performance. Very sort of showy and, you know, it's the sort of thing which I think people would be willing to dismiss a little bit because it's so over the top and big. You could say, well, she had the chance to be over the top and big, so maybe it wasn't quite as good as the understated performance of Lily and Sandra. But if I was sitting there with my ballot form, I'd have those three in front of me. I would probably discount Emma Stone because I'm like, well, how can I vote for Emma Stone over like this Native American woman who's also, you know, worthy? But then I'm like, well, you know, I could give it to a foreign actress who's been incredible in two movies. I think I'll go Sandra. And so if other people follow that same sort of thought process, like maybe she could be a surprise win there. And I would love to see that. I think that'd be an amazing moment on the telecast.
Actor in a leading role. Also some late mail for a couple of the nominees that didn't seem to have it in the bag a little while ago, maybe they do now. Bradley Cooper for Maestro, Colman Domingo for Rustin, Paul Giamatti for The Holdovers, Cillian Murphy for Oppenheimer, and Jeffrey Wright for American Fiction. Wright is the one who's getting a lot of love. This film will suffer because not a lot of people have seen it. It's not high on everyone's radar, but by all accounts, Wright, who's also very good in Rustin, in a small role. Wright won the Independent Spirit Award the other day. Cooper's out. I watched Rustin last night. It's not a very good film, but Colman Domingo is very striking and over the top in it. Who should win? I'm going to say Murphy for Oppenheimer, who will win. Giamatti for The Holdovers. Can we give it two acting awards? Maybe. Yeah, I think Giamatti will win. Cillian Murphy should win.
I think Cillian Murphy will win. I think Giamatti should win. And here's the thing. I think one of the criticisms I made of The Holdovers, if I could even criticize such a beautiful film, is Sorry, that's just a nod towards Simon, who did not care for that movie, and he is very wrong on it.
I did not care for the film.
Yeah. But look, one of the things I did say was that he gave a performance that was very similar to other Paul Giamatti films before, and to me that's a strength and a positive of the movie. There was so much I loved about it, and part of seeing Giamatti back on screen playing this kind of a role was a very big part of why I enjoyed it. Look, my heart says it's Giamatti, but also Killian, I kind of feel it's so much Oppenheimer's year that he's probably got that. But Paul Giamatti, I think, fantastic. And also, he didn't win for Sideways, which he probably should have won for back in the day. Like, for that sort of duel, let's go back and recognize him again. I think that's, yeah, it's worth it.
Interesting. All right. Best director. This is getting tough. It shouldn't be this tough because it's been kind of a one-horse race for so long, but there's a lot of buzz coming out that different things are going to happen on the day. Best director, Justin Trier for Anatomy of a Fall, Scorsese for Killers of the Flower Moon, Nolan for Oppenheimer, Yorgos Lanthimos for Poor Things, and the great Jonathan Glazer for Zone of Interest. Now, I mentioned in a Facebook post during the week that I think there's going to be a split this year. I think that and it doesn't happen very often, although it's happened a little bit in the last decade or so, that the Best Director Award will not be the director of the Best Picture winner. Now, my way of thinking here is that Nolan may get the writing of... No, other way around. I think Nolan will win director for this, but a different film will win Best Picture that we'll get to. I don't think there's anyone else really in the race. I think Justin Trier will get Anatomy of Fall screenplay nod, which opens this category up to give it to Nolan, and then we'll get on to the Best Picture in a moment. But what are your thoughts?
Oh, look, in terms of the concept of this chat, in terms of who should win, like, it's Justin Trier. I think that what she did on that film was just incredible. So one of the, like, if people haven't seen Anatomy of a Fall, like, I understand that the vibe that you're probably feeling at the moment is it's just another foreign language movie. You know, critics love this movie. It's not really that accessible, but it really is accessible. The one thing with Anatomy of a Fall is that we opened this podcast talking about Law and Order. Anatomy of a Fall is it's 2.5 hours long, which maybe even get close to 3 hours. It's a long movie. It doesn't feel that long. It feels like you're watching one or two Law and Order episodes back to back. It is an investigation into what took place. It is a courtroom trial that exists. But what's incredible about the movie and what elevates it beyond being just a double Law and Order back to back is the quality of the writing. It's about the direction. It's about the thematic underpinnings of the movie. Like, it really elevates what is a fairly tried and tested bit of screen experience in something fairly special. What is fascinating about it, and this may be a bit of foreigner interpretation on it, but what I really appreciated about it was being able to see the way that the French legal system is quite different to the American. What's different about the French is that it's less adversarial, even though it is adversarial, but it's actually more a conversation between the various parties. And there's a lot of opportunities to go in depth about things. It is very much, hey, look, that was kind of interesting what you said a few minutes ago. Can we just go back and explore that? And so they'll try to get to the truth through what is a very sort of community-orientated legal experience. And she brings
that
us to the
fascinating screen. Part of the film.
Yeah, it's very much, because it is conversational, that camera work that's taking place and the way that the actors are responding to the camera is that it's, as I said, it was conversational. So it's a very human, very sort of, I use the word human again. It's a human flow.
No, I know what you mean. On the surface, it's a contemporary. On the surface, it's a very contemporary courtroom thriller and a procedural to some extent, but all that flows underneath that facade, the very, quote-unquote, as you said a couple of times now, human elements, the interactions between all the key characters in there, and, yes, the dog, are just are what makes it such a compelling two-and-a-half-hour film. So Nolan, yes, you're right. I think she should win for this. Nolan will win for director, I think, is what we're getting at.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right.
All right. So we finally get to the Best Picture nominees. American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie. Shit, there's a giant HelloFresh ad right in the middle of the list. Here we are. The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, The Zone of Interest. To which I will say it's such a shame, but I think Past Lives and probably Poor Things are going to fall by the wayside this year. I think Killers of the Flower Moon is going to walk away empty-handed. Barbie will get a bunch of the below-the-line stuff. American Fiction, I think, is probably going to go away with zero. I think of the Best Picture nominees, this is where it's going to break down. I think Nolan's going to be awarded for Oppenheimer. They're going to give Zone of Interest the international film, which leaves Anatomy of a Fall open to get the Best Picture award. And I think that's what's going to happen, and I think that's probably what should happen. Obviously, there's the huge wave that is Oppenheimer, and if it turns into an Oppenheimer night, we'll know by the time this category comes around what's going to win. But for me, it's going to be Anatomy of a Fall here, as it should be.
Yeah, look, I mean, what should win is Anatomy of a Fall by a long mile, although, you know, it is such a difficult year. Like, usually I'll look at, like, the list of nominated movies and I'll say, well, this is clearly the best movie and the rest were all, you know, perfectly fine, but, you know, some of them just seem like Academy picks, some of them don't really quite have the merit. But, like, I look at this year and almost all of them are films that are very worthy of being the best picture of the year. Like, there is some amazingly good titles. Past Lives, we haven't really talked about that much. I think it was an exceptional film that personally, I don't really care for the star of the movie, and to me, she's the weakest point of what the film had to offer. I do appreciate that I'm in the minority on that one. People seem to love her. People love the Gretel Lee. It's Anatomy of the Fall's year, though. The Holdovers, I have so much love for, and I do wonder whether the Holdovers may start to eat into a little bit of the same audience that Anatomy of a Fall might have chipped away with. So the people that want to break away from Oppenheimer and see, you know, a couple of films they genuinely loved and responded to with great affection.
I think there's probably a lot of underlying love for Poor Things. I think people would like to see that win. It was such a bracing and original and strange movie-going experience that also worked as a very human story. Like, I get she gave a big performance, but she never lost sight of the real human character at the heart of that big performance, and I think that's where a lot of her acclaim is coming from. I also think that Zone of Interest is a film that's getting a lot of traction at the moment, and I think that's why it'll probably shore up. Maybe the swing towards it has come a bit late in terms of the voting, but I think it'll take the if Zone of Interest, like I said, if Zone of Interest wins the International Film Prize, then Anatomy of a Fall will win here. If Anatomy of a Fall wins the International Prize, it'll open it up for Oppenheimer in Best Picture. That's how I think it's going to play out.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, the thing with Poor Things, and I feel the same way about Zone of Interest, is that I really, like, with Zone Poor Things especially, you can't really say this in Zone of Interest at all, but I really enjoyed the experience watching Poor Things. But the further I got away from that movie, the less it really resonated with me. Okay, whereas the same can't be true for Zone of Interest, where I've been thinking about that movie quite a fair bit. Okay, but I probably don't respect it as much in the weeks that have followed than I did just after seeing the movie. Whereas my respect for The Holdovers and for Anatomy of a Fall just grows every time I think about it. Okay, both of those films, like, are near and dear to my heart, and I can't stop thinking about either of those pictures. But yeah, Anatomy of a Fall. It's Anatomy of a Fall. Well, Oppenheimer's going to win. I think the momentum behind it is just too strong to really ignore. But Anatomy of a Fall, easily the best movie.
A quick on the fly, yes or no, The Boy and the Heron or Spider-Man Across the Universe for animated film?
Oh, what else is nominated?
Elemental, Nimona and Robot Dreams. Nimona should win. It's a wonderful.
Yeah, I haven't seen Robot Dreams yet. I need to give that a look. Look, I think Boy and the Heron probably wins, if only because it's most likely Miyazaki's last movie. That said, I think that that Spider-Man movie really was something pretty exceptional.
Sure.
That's my pick as being the best of the year.
And can Godzilla Minus One beat a whole lot of big Hollywood films to take out the visual effects made on a quarter of the budget, but providing 20 times the thrill that the creator, Guardians of the Galaxy 3, Mission Impossible, or Napoleon did?
Look, here's the thing that usually happens in Academy Awards campaigns. Often there'll be some fairly negative press coverage of the front runners for it. This isn't necessarily like a premium, prestigious, nomination, like either way. But I haven't heard anyone really criticizing the Godzilla effort. But it's worth calling bullshit on the idea that, oh, they've done it on such a small budget, considering how little a lot of the people working on that movie were paid. Okay, this is a it's a non-union movie with some, and look, there is a lot of discussion happening on the fringes of the media, which it should be a bigger conversation than it is, about how little money some film professionals are making in Japan, particularly those working on things like special effects and anime. The conversation saying, oh, they've achieved so much on such a limited budget, it's really disappointing to hear that that's become one of the dominant narratives around this film, considering that, you know, people working on these movies should be being paid more money than they are.
If that helps it win an Oscar, and that Oscar win helps them negotiate higher rates, or in fact takes them out of their domestic industry and takes them to where they can earn some real big bucks in Hollywood, then that's a good thing. I think it will win the Oscar. I think the love for it came along at just the right time in the voting cycle for it to pick up the Oscars. So, but you're not wrong. That absolutely should be spoken about. It was an issue that was impacting Hollywood, the workload and what they were being paid when they were told to rush out a whole bunch of films in time for the American summer release. It's been a debate that's been going on for years in Hollywood. So,
well, ironically, the entire reason that the awards exist, Simon, was to try to not pay Hollywood professionals much money. Like, it was seen as, oh, you know, if we give them prestige, then they'll work for less money. Like, that's the very foundation of these awards.
We came so close to having a very positive intermission, and then you had to sully it right at the end there. Anyway, let's move on. We're done. We've got to get more reviews out of the way and do This Week in History and the Birthday Quiz. Dan, rush us through the second half of the show.
Oh, gosh. What else have we been watching? Simon, what have you been watching?
I had a look at Spaceman, which is one of the strangest films I have seen in a long time. This is the one that stars Adam Sandler as an astronaut heading to the furthest reaches of the galaxy. He starts to go a little bit cuckoo, and his cuckoo-ness manifests as a giant spider voiced by Paul Dano, who helps him come to terms with the fact that he's been an awful husband to his wife, Carrie Mulligan, who is planning to leave him back on Earth. Some of the internet wags have been calling this Inter Sandler, with reference to Interstellar and about what it means, what sort of mental health issues you can experience deep in space. I rode the roller coaster of reactions when I watched this movie. There were moments that I thought were preposterous. There were moments that I thought were quite profound. There were certainly some stunning visuals in it. It's a very Euro-arty kind of science fiction movie. The stuff that Sandler's doing for Netflix, whether it's the the one that he did with the Safdie brothers that went to Netflix, and his basketball coach one, and now this, he's doing really interesting, and this is not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but it's quite a bold bit of filmmaking for everyone involved. So it's called Spaceman on Netflix.
Yeah, viewership was really, really low for this one compared to some other Adam Sandler joints.
Yeah, the reviews have been love it or hate it kind of stuff about it, which I get because it is an odd, odd film. It's not going to be anyone or everyone's cup of tea, but we'll see. What have you been watching, Dan Barrett?
What have I been watching? I've been checking out the new Netflix series, The Gentlemen. Now, The Gentleman is the TV series spin-off from the Guy Ritchie movie, which had the same name. It was back in about 2019 that film came out. It's got a very similar presence, but apparently you can watch them without having seen one or the other. I haven't seen the movie, so I was coming in very cold, and I was somewhat confused as to whether or not I was missing out on something by not having seen the movie, and it was a bit confusing. Well, I just didn't know that if I understood everything that was happening on screen. But as I've come to learn, you can watch one without the other. So the things I was confused by is probably more a fault of storytelling than it is necessarily of the fact it's a spinoff. The premise of this one is basically that you've got Theo James, who people have seen in White Lotus and that Time Traveler's Wife TV series from a few years ago as well. He's a young army guy who gets brought back to the family. His father's died and has left him ahead of his older brother the family estate and business. Basically, from that point in, he starts dealing with some weed dealers, a whole lot of violence. It basically becomes a Guy Ritchie story. What threw me while I was watching this one is that I think about Guy Ritchie as a filmmaker. He started out making some very sort of low-budget, gritty movies with a lot of low-life crims that have a lot of spirit and energy, and heart's probably not quite the right word for it, but we'll say spirit and energy. A lot of personality. Yeah, that's a great way to phrase it. A lot of fun dialogue. And the further that he's been getting in his career, the more glitzy things have become, the more surface and shallow they are. And I don't know, like, it feels as though with The Gentleman and a couple of other recent films he's made, he's trying to return back to that Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels world. But he's doing it with this just sheen and glitz and glamour that just kind of undercuts where the fun and spirit of something like this is. When The Gentleman released its publicity photos about a month or so ago, they were really sort of gritty and had just a lot of real spark and vitality to them. I was really hoping to see that in the TV series, but it's just not quite there. It's perfectly amiable. I could easily watch more of this, but I wasn't really bananas for it. If I forgot to keep on watching it, I wouldn't notice.
I still think it's amazing that of all the Walt Disney live action musicals that have come down the pipe in the last 10 years, that he's made the best one with Aladdin.
Oh, that's right. He made Aladdin. He's had such a strange career.
Such an odd career. Who'd have thought that turning Will Smith blue and putting Guy Ritchie in charge of the Aladdin story was going to work so well? But it did. By far the best one, actually. Okay, so that's what we've been watching. Dan Barrett, a tester for you this week in history. All right, here we go.
What do we got?
March 9, 1954 was a good year. A TV commercial for Castro Decorators on WNBT TV New York holds what special place in broadcast history?
So I feel that we've had this question before on the podcast. I've been doing it for a couple of years now, and I feel it may have come up, last year or the year before. But yeah, is this possibly the first color ad broadcast on TV?
Yes, it was the first color ad. Maybe I am starting. Maybe I need to get a new website to get my questions from. Yes, for Castro Decorators on WNBT TV New York had the first color ad on broadcast television. What actress, which actress put on 18 kilograms in 70 days to play the title role in this Aussie film hit released on March 10, 1995?
Okay. You got this from the same website as the other one, right?
No, I didn't. No, this one I had to sort of go around because there was nothing much happening in the early March. So, no, I didn't. We definitely haven't had this before.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not accusing you of that, but I'm accusing you maybe of getting it off an American website, only because I feel that Muriel's Wedding came out in 1994 and not 1995, and it wasn't anywhere near this week.
You might be right. Dan Barrett, yes, you may have caught me out there using an American website, March 10, 1995. You're right, it was 94, same year as Priscilla. So my apologies to listeners. This week in history has been sullied once again. But I think I've got this one right. March 12, 2019, federal prosecutors charged dozens in U.S. college admission scandal, including two actresses.
Oh, which two actresses? That's a generous phrase with one of them. So one who is one of the greats is Ms. Felicity Huffman. Ms. Felicity Huffman married to William H. Macy, who appeared on an episode of L.A. Law I was watching just last night. But anyway, neither here nor there. It really is. He played a poetry publisher. Pre-Fargo, obviously.
Who was the other actress?
The other actress would be one star of Summertime, Laurie Loughlin.
Summertime, really? That's an odd one to go to. Wasn't she in
Full House?
Full House, that's what I'm trying to think of. All right, let's go with the birthday quiz and wrap this baby up. Oh, I went all FM radio for a minute there, didn't I? Okay.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
Okay, Dan Barrett, it's a famous co-star edition. Now, I want to point out that this week's birthday quiz was one of the hardest I've ever had to do. I had quite an interesting bunch of birthday buddies, but I just couldn't piece them together. So this one's become a famous co-star edition. Who of all these actors co-starred with at some point in their career? One famous co-star. March 9, 1955, the beautiful Ornella Muti, one of the great beauties of stage and screen. Many remember her from Flash Gordon, but that's not a clue. March 10, 1958, Sharon Stone. March 10, 1940, another great screen beauty in Chuck Norris. And March 13, 1956, one Dana Delaney. So make this last a bit because it took me so long to find an answer for it. And I've got a cough. Which famous co-star links these four birthday buddies?
So Simon sent me this list last night with the request that I don't solve it in anywhere faster than 2 seconds. Awkwardly, I looked straight down at it and I picked it from the get-go. So I don't know who Ornella Muti is, but yeah, Dana Delaney I know from two things. She was in China Beach, and also she's been appearing in a little series called Tulsa King, opposite one Sylvester Stallone. And I looked at that going, okay, well, is it China Beach or Tulsa King? And then I looked up and saw Sharon Stone, who has appeared directly opposite Sylvester Stallone. I was like, okay, well, I think that's it. And then I thought about the beautiful Chuck Norris and remembered they were in an Expendables together. So this has to be Sylvester Stallone.
It is Sylvester Stallone. Sharon Stone starred opposite him in a junky little action film from the mid-90s called The Specialist. And Ornella Muti starred alongside Marissa Tomei and Sylvester Stallone in the vastly underrated farce Oscar that was directed by John Landis. Oh. Ornella Muti, she was in that. Many people will remember, certainly men of our age will remember Ornella Muti from Flash Gordon. She was the beautiful princess. I'm slowly choking, excuse me. And she had a brief Hollywood career in one of her other main roles, was in the much maligned but really quite enjoyable Oscar. So there you go. We're done. Podcast in the can, baby.
I remember really liking Oscar, but I was also maybe 10 years old when it came out. So, take that for whatever it's worth.
Certainly helps. This has been Screen Watching. Get us on Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast, on Threads and on YouTube at Screen Watching, or write us an email, screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. What is going on with my throat? Excuse me. Where can we see your work, Dan Barrett?
Okay, well, as Simon Foster, reviewer of How to Have Sex, is having trouble with his throat now, I'm going to move on and let you know that I do a newsletter called Always Be Watching. You can find that one every day at alwaysbewatching.com or in your inbox if you sign up to it, which you should. Each day it's got the latest news and information about what's been happening on TV and streaming stuff just generally. You can also find my weekly newsletter called Always Be Streaming, and it's a guide to the TV shows and movies that launched that very week. And then also this week I updated my YouTube channel with a video review, hands-on explainer type thing. It's 55 goddamn minutes of me looking at the Hubble device. So if you're interested in Hubble and wanting to see that thing going through at extreme minute detail, check out that video because it'll offer you what you're looking for. And then the last thing I just wanted to sort of go into was a quick run back to what else have you been watching. Last night I watched the movie Summer School, which we've discussed here on the podcast a number of times. This is the classic 1987-ish movie starring Mark Harmon and Kirstie Alley. Mark Harmon is a goofy sports, like a gym coach, who is tasked with looking after a class of delinquents over summer, the titular summer school.
It's like Dead Poets Society, but more fun.
Yeah, with a lot more dick jokes, largely. But when I was watching that, something that I thought was a bit interesting was Carl Reiner was the director of the movie and makes a very fun cameo appearance early in the film, but written by one Jeff Franklin. And Jeff Franklin, we all know as the man that hired Lori Loughlin in a show called Full House when he created and ran that program.
Look at the circles we come full in. That didn't sound right. Look at the circle that we've created to bring us back to Lori Loughlin. That's a pretty profound bit of podcasting there, Dan Barrett. Well done.
It is. That means it's time to log off. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week with there'll probably be some Oscar talk as we do wrap up. But, you know, there will definitely be less talk about sex and how to having of it. What have I got on my run through? I'm looking at Netflix's Super Sex. Folks, we'll see you next week.